The Bane Free Radio Hour.
On the podcast, Earks away on a sea of Christmas cheer and stars. Resistance is brutal and fun. Plus, we continue with the complete audiobook serialization of Larry Correia's Son of the Black Sword. All right now. Welcome to the Bane Free Radio Hour podcast. It's an honor to have you along. I'm Bane Senior Editor Tony Daniel. We have part two of a roundtable discussion with Michael Z. Williamson and authors in a great new anthology called Freehold Resistance. This is a short story collection edited by Michael Z. Williamson, well, a story collection, but it's also a complete novel or story cycle in that it tells the story of the resistance during the UN invasion of Freehold that's recounted in Mike's groundbreaking novel, Freehold. These are the stories of the individual resistance fighters who come together in a libertarian manner in defense of the most libertarian planet, Grania, which is where Freehold is, after the fascistic UN decides they've had enough of these freedom-loving types and invades. We have Michael Z. Williamson, Jessica Schlenker, Chris and Jamie Denote, and Jamie Ibsen on the roundtable. And we continue with the audiobook serialization of Larry Correia's great high fantasy novel, Son of the Black Sword. Now here's the news. The September e-arcs are ready to spark up the winter skies and e-readers everywhere. Now, an e-arc is the path a magical flying sleigh takes through the air when its inertial compensators have absorbed a little too much elven turbocharge and reindeer juice and go into afterburner mode. No. An e-arc is actually something else entirely. It's an electronic advanced reading copy of a book, which is the book as an e-book, that has been copy edited, but not quite proofread all the way through yet. It's what we used to call the galley proofs, and we will sell those to you sometimes 3-4 months in advance, so you can have a look at your favorite series, check out new authors. Lots of reasons you might want one of these great e-arcs, and people love them. Out now in e-arc form for December is Force Perspectives by the great Tim Powers, Egyptian Death Magic in a Haunted Los Angeles. Fugitive federal agents Sebastian Vickery and Ingrid Castaigne are both sensitive to the ghosts that haunt the modern Los Angeles freeways. They are plunged into the supernatural secrets of the vast city and its history, from the fallout of satanic indie movies of the 60s to the unquiet La Brea tar pit at midnight, to a haunted sunken city off the coast of San Pedro seeking to rise again. Vickery and Castine may be old hands at dealing with the spirit world of L.A., but they have never been in a pursuit so deadly with the stakes so high. Also out in December is Castaway Resolution, e-art by Eric Flint and Reich E. Spohr. Survive and thrive on an alien planet. The Kamei family and a second group of castaways, led by the redoubtable Sergeant Campbell, have finally joined forces. Landing on the bizarre planet Lincoln, they have survived crash landings, venom-filled bites, disease, and even the destruction and consumption of one of their floating island homes. They've learned to live, even to prosper, in this strange new place, but the resourcefulness of the castaways may not be enough, because the planet Lincoln is far from done with them yet. Finally for December, out now is Ship of Destiny e-arc by Frank Chadwick. The secret of immortality is within reach. When a mysterious alien probe materializes from jump space and remotely reprograms USS Cameron Bay's star drive, Naval Reserve Officer Sam Bitka and his crew begin an involuntary voyage that takes them 3,000 light-years out of known space and into the heart of an ancient, unknown civilization. But the genetically altered immortals, known as the Guardians, soon turn murderously violent. Now Sam and his crew must elude capture and return with the news of a powerful new civilization bent on their destruction. But the crew of the Bay may also be carrying a secret that will change life in the galaxy forever. The path to immortality. Ship of Destiny, E-Arc by Frank Chadwick. Castaway Resolution, E-Arc by Eric Flint and Reich E. Spohr. And Force Perspectives, E-Arc by Tim Powers, are all available exclusively at Bane.com. Go there, check them out, and read until the reindeer come. This is part two of a two-part roundtable discussion. Part one is available on last week's podcast. I want to welcome Michael Z. Williamson, Jessica Schlenker, Chris DeNote, and Jamie DeNote, and Jamie Ibsen to the podcast. Hello, folks.
Hello.
Hey, how are you?
Hey.
Hello.
Let me introduce our distinguished panel, who are going to be talking about, of course, Freehold Resistance, which we'll talk about in just a moment, is a new book edited by Michael Z. Williamson, set in his Freehold universe. Michael Z. Williamson is variously an immigrant from the UK and Canada, a retired veteran of the U.S. Army and U.S. Air Force with service in the Middle East, a consultant on disaster preparedness and military matters to private clients, manufacturers, TV and movie productions, and occasional DOD elements, bladesmith, award-winning and best-selling editor and author, and his hobby of collecting weapons has led him into an arms race in which he outguns Barbados and Iceland so far, and I can attest to that. Jessica Schlenker holds an MS in Information Security and Assurance, a bevy of industrial certifications, and a BS in Biology. There's a lot of letters after her name. She works as a professional nerd in the field of IT security. Sadly, she is too much of a white hat to actually combine these specialties into creating her own cyborg army, or so she says, but she's thought about it. Chris DeNote has served 20 years so far in the United States Air Force and Air National Guard, Pennsylvania and Ohio. He has deployed in Operations Enduring Freedom and Iraqi Freedom. Chris is a graduate of the U.S. Air Force Academy and the USAF Weapons School. He holds an MA in Military History from Norwich University and a Master's in Strategic Studies from the Air War College. A very amateur musician, Chris has also played saxophone and bass in several bands. Just like he feels if he plays the saxophone like Deacon Blue. He was born in Pennsylvania and raised in South Jersey, and resides wherever the Air Force tells him to with his wife and co-author Jamie and their daughter Remy. And Jamie is also here. There's two Jamies. Jamie DeNote is a veteran of the Florida Army National Guard and U.S. Army Reserve. She mobilized for Operation Noble Eagle in Washington. Man, we have a distinguished panel here. Washington, D.C. Jamie is a graduate of Seattle University ROTC and holds a B.A. in Criminal Justice. Due to the demanding PCS schedule, she's a stay-at-home mom and a military spouse and is working on her first novel. And finally, we have Jamie Ibsen. And Jamie Chris, you wanted to actually let me have you do your disclaimer after we get to Jamie. Jamie Ibsen was born in London, Ontario, Canada, and he's in Canada right now. And joined the CF Army Reserves as an infantryman while still in high school. A six-month tour of Bosnia in 2001 impressed upon him just how awful things are in North America compared to awesome things are in North America compared to most of the rest of the world, which was an important lesson for a naive 20-year-old kid. In 2007, he joined Canadian law enforcement and has been posted to the left coast ever since. He is married to a very supportive wife and has two shockingly supportive cats. That is shocking. So, Chris DeNote, maybe throw out your disclaimer there so we know that it's you talking and not the United States government, thank God.
Thank you. Yeah, I just want to make clear, of course, that anything that you guys hear from me during this podcast represents my own personal opinions only and does not represent the official stance of the Department of Defense, the United States Air Force, or the National Guard Bureau. In other words, it's just me talking for me.
Well, we need to talk about these leopards.
What the heck? They are really dangerous.
Yeah, I referenced them first in The Weapon. So yeah, they have military working dogs. They've got some dolphins. And well, they have specially bred military combat leopards. Leopards have better senses than dogs. If you can get them tractable enough, which sometimes happens, cheetahs are fairly tractable, leopards, it varies. They've got a lot of range. They're phenomenal at hiding. For years, there was this myth that leopards were endangered, and everyone who dealt with them said, no, they're just that good at hiding. You don't see them. Even when they've got trackers on them, they're damn near invisible. And they're highly intelligent. Some of them have disabled traps. And as I put it at the panel we did, yeah, anyone hears a dog, you know, ooh, oh, nice doggy. You hear a cat go, you know it's going to eat you. I mean, there's no nice kitty to something that sounds like that. And then if you put them in body armor and chameleon camouflage, you just have a pair of jaws coming out of the forest with claws. You know, it's great for intel gathering, and if it turns violent, you know, it's a terror weapon. So Jimmy caught up with me at a convention, and he had so he considered how they would train these. Well, no, actually, I hadn't. And he had a whole background on how they would recruit the leopard handlers and train the leopards. And it's like, oh, this is cool. And, you know, he had this whole time frame that he put together, you know, dedicated fan of the universe. And I was like, you know what? Some leopards would go great in this. Why don't I just hand that off to Jamie? Jamie, do you want to write about the leopards?
Yes, I do. That would be awesome. That's basically what I said. And yeah, I mean, I had one of the cardinal sins of writing in somebody else's universe is contradicting what's been established. You know, getting the details wrong. You know, not being able to stay within canon. And so, when I wanted to approach Mike and say, hey, so about those leopards, huh? One of the first things that I did was I basically reread everything that Mike had written in the universe, and it turned out I'd missed a couple things. But yeah, I put together, you know, a timeline that tried to use, you know, all the little references to seasons or to what month the thing happened or how many weeks passed between this and that. And I built a timeline of the war, of the books. As Forged in Blood came out, I was able to fill in more of the backstory before Ken and Kendra's stories in Freehold and Weapon. And, you know, character lists that we could pick from and stuff like that. And it ended up being useful, which was awesome. And so then, yeah, Mike, you know, messages me the one day. He's like, so send me some samples of your writing. And that's ominous as hell when you've never been published anywhere. And I did. And he said, okay, we can work with that. You know, here's the deal. Forged in Blood's going really well. I'd like to do another anthology. I'd like you to do the cats. And so for about a week, I was walking a foot off the ground. And then as the stories started to roll in, people were asking questions, you know, asking about, you know, well, is there a character that's like this? Is there a character like that? And then with the character lists that I had from the books, I was able to be like, you know, yes, Mr. Korea, if you're looking for, you know, a well-to-do businessman who would have an assassin on retainer, here's a couple, and that kind of thing. And so then, you know, one of the things with the leopards was putting together, well, what does it really look like to take, you know, a brand new eyes shut kitten and turn it into a near sapient partner for a special forces soldier. And so, you know, I talked to some dog handlers that I know from work and learned that, you know, the current dog handler model would not work for how Freehold does things. And then, you know, started asking my questions about, well, okay, so in the humans call it duty, Capstick is doing this, Capstick is doing that, you know, and humans call it duty. If people haven't read it, you need to, because it's one of the coolest human, not human first person's perspective type books you'll ever read, or stories you'll ever read. And so that was actually where I started writing the Leopard stuff, was I wanted to write what happened next. You know, Capstick, his handler is killed, and he hunts down the UN team that took him out and picks them off one by one, you know, and, you know, like the second last guy in the patrol realizes that the last guy in the patrol isn't behind him anymore, and what happened and that kind of thing. And by the time the third soldier in the squad's been taken out, they realize that they're being hunted and they start to panic. And then by the end of it, Capstick, you know, he's in a Hurt Locker himself, but he limps off. And so I was like, well, okay, where could we go from that? And unfortunately, that story is the one that didn't make the cut, for a couple different reasons, which in retrospect make a lot of sense. But, you know, I had these characters in mind for the story that I wanted to do. And so I said, well, what if it's now the end of the war? You know, we know that the Battle of Braided Bluff, the big battle where Kendra is out holding the line all by herself, more or less, we know that happens in April. And so I backed it up just a little bit and started doing this story about the handlers, who are a weird blend of, you know, Delta Force-style door kickers and long-range recon patrol types who can live off the earth. You know, they head out with
and mountain men
with their packs. yeah. You know, they can survive, you know, based on what the natural world has to offer already. And so by the time we catch up with the handlers in Cry Havoc, they're wearing, you know, buckskin clothes and furs that they have made because their uniforms fell apart to tatters a long time ago. You know, going all the way back to, can we get boots? You know, that's one of the things that comes out is when the leader of the handlers is, you know, getting his troops to put together a wish list. One of them, she's like, can we get boots? Tell me we can get boots. We need boots. And so then, you know, they decide that, you know, they're not going to win this battle of attrition. You know, we need to start going on the offensive. And they head back to the nature preserve where the leopard washouts have been released to go live their life as cats, and try to recruit some of them back into the operations side of things. So
we're going to recruit,
you know,
some,
like,
feral leopards to fight a battle. Nothing could go wrong with this idea.
No, how could that possibly go wrong? So, so, you know, Mike was mentioning about how stealthy they are. You know, there's the standard, you know, issue leopard that we see in Africa and India and the Middle East that, you know, everybody knows. But then there's also, like, clouded leopards, you know, which are more home in Southeast Asia. And as we were working on the book, the story comes out, you know, that this cat that has been written off as extinct for the last 40 years, you know, suddenly made an appearance in this town in, I think it was Thailand. And
yeah,
everybody went,
Taiwan,
no way, really? Taiwan?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's this clouded leopard, which is smaller than a regular leopard, you know, but apparently it's so good at avoiding people that we haven't seen one in 40 years, and we've written it off as extinct, and we're going, well, hell, if it's that good, then of course we're going to, you know, use them for the leopard program. And one of the cats that they recruit out of the nature preserve is one of these clouded leopards who was too aggressive, unfortunately, you know, to be a recon cat. And so they're going, well, you know, like, maybe a really aggressive cat is exactly what we need right now. And
front toward enemy.
And so they exactly. So they go all the way back to Mirror Lake, which is the primary recruiting and training facility for Freehold Forces, and that's been occupied by the UN. And over a period of time, they and their feral cats and their trained cats start stalking the troops that operate out of the base until they manage to get the company to go out and try to pick a fight, and they lose.
If I recall the correct, it's the last seven surviving leopard handlers. I mean, that's how far they've
Jefferson
been.
Team is The Jefferson team is mentioned. But things go badly for them, and so then word, you know, gets to the Tannaville team. One of the things is, you know, we spend a lot of time in Freehold and Weapon in Jefferson dealing with 3rd Army, 3rd Mobile Legion, 3rd Mobile Assault Regiment, you know, and they're out of Heilbronn Base. But Mike does say that there are also the Megiddo bases and the Merrill bases at these other places on the continent. So the team that I'm dealing with, they start as the survivors of the Merrill base team outside of Tannaville, which is one of the other major cities on the continent, and so then they start making their way east towards the basic training facility, and then they end up getting scooped at the end because the Jefferson team has been wiped out, and Nauman needs his handlers to go do sneaky squirrel stuff up in the woods. As he's prepping all the rest of his troops to go pick a fight.
So, I mean, there's 7 handlers, there's less than 20 cats, fewer than 20 cats, and they are depopulating a base 1x2x1 late at night. Yeah, and no one knows what's happening.
They,
as what I'm
eventually
patrol,
the,
it's terrifying.
Yeah. Eventually the base commander, you know, they realize that this isn't, you know, this isn't just, you know, an accident. This isn't rippers or whatever that are eating his troops. It's hostile intent, and part of that, you know, was taking a page from what the Gurkhas did to the Nazis in World War II. You know, where they would find a sentry who was asleep, or find a pair of sentries who was asleep, and they would kill one of them, and let the other guy wake up to find out that his buddy had been assassinated while they both dozed off, and just let that play havoc on their morale for a while.
And of course, he has to go into the brass why he was a sister.
Exactly. So there's, you know, a fair bit of that goes on. And then eventually, it becomes like an adverse correlation of forces, but the UN doesn't realize that they're on the wrong side of that.
Well, those lepers are cool, and that story, I believe it's the first story you ever wrote, right, Mike? That it's really a moving tale about the leopard that fights back. What was the name of that again?
The Humans Call It Duty.
The Humans Call It Duty. Yeah. No, Cry Havoc is a wonderful follow up because at the end of
when I originally wrote that, it got rejected by several magazines. And one of them, you know, this is a simple tale of revenge and killing. It isn't science fiction. Like, well, the character's not human. So one level, that makes it science fiction. And finally, Joe Haldeman asked for a Future Weapons of War story for an anthology he was doing, and I sent it, and Joe Haldeman liked it. And I figure if Joe Haldeman likes it, there's nothing wrong with the story. I'm sure there is higher praise somewhere, but in sci-fi, that's pretty damn good praise. So I was, I was pleased.
No, it's a very good story, and this is and Cry Havoc is a great follow-up to, you know, what the heck are all these leopards about, and it seems real and integrated into the world the way that Jamie has done it.
The UN gets to this point and they realize that, you know, literally everything on this planet is trying to kill them. The animals, the people, everything on this planet is trying to kill them. There's no middle ground.
One of the things that you know, Mike instructed me is that, look, if you're going to write leopards, you need to read about them first. And he pointed me to a series of books by Peter Hathaway Capstick, who is, you know, who Capstick the Leopard is named for. And he was a big game hunter in Africa in the 50s and 60s. And, you know, he talks about hunting, you know, several different animals and you know, it's bush stories and that kind of thing. But the one story that really, you know, drives home just how devious these cats can be, you know, and this is a real world story, is this cat that was wounded by a hunter and took off into the grass. And Peter goes, oh, crap. and he digs out his wounded cat kit, which is like a leather bomber jacket with vinyl strips sewn into it, and one of those a Marine Corps gorget to protect his neck, because that's one of the ways the cats will kill, is they'll bite between the vertebrae of the neck and just bop the entire neck apart. And then the rest of it is antiseptic, morphine, and stitches. And that's how he prepares to go, you know, track down a wounded cat. And tourniquets, yeah. So they go off.
First batteries for the radio to call for the evac plane. Yeah.
And they and they're following the blood trail, and and they see one of those lone trees on the savanna out ahead of them, and the cat is making a beeline for it, and oh no! And
actually, he didn't see anything. He didn't see anything until he got there.
But well, exactly, he didn't see anything. But they stop for a smoke and another drink, and then as he's going under this tree, which is where the blood trail is, the cat ends up. It has died, and it falls out of the tree, and it lands right on them. But what they didn't realize was that the cat had actually gone past the tree, doubled back on itself, came at its own blood trail at an angle, and then went up the tree and was overlooking its back trail, waiting to jump down on them. And if they hadn't stopped for that smoke and that drink, then the cat would have been alive, and it would have come down out of the tree and torn them apart. You know, this is a cat that realized that it was being hunted and did everything it could to turn the tails on them. And that was when I kind of got shivers and went, these things are terrifying. Perfect.
The record for an African leopard was it dropped into the middle of a army patrol. It wounded all 8 of the patrol and got out in, they figure, under 30 seconds, and nobody got a shot off. It dropped into the middle like a buzzsaw. And
so when you've got 20-some of them leopard, and they've been trained to do this.
Yeah. The Ruji Priyag leopard in India had over 300 confirmed kills. That was the one that could disable traps. And they set traps for it, and the leopard would disable the traps and eat the bait.
Well, they're very scary animals, and they work well here. Also in the book is Star Home, a really good story by you, Mike.
The other stories, John F. Holmes does a story of a veteran who is cautioning common patience to the people in his area. It's like, we're massively outnumbered. We're not the military. We don't want to get into this fight. And then the fight comes to them, and he has to stand up and, take charge of what there is. Brad Torgerson's story was very reminiscent of Drake in some fashion, David Drake. It's a supply depot, Freehold Supply Depot. They realize they've been located, and they load everything onto trucks and unask the area under fire. And these are, the sick, lame, and lazy. This is retirees, people who were disabled in service, people who couldn't quite qualify for combat arms, so they're not officially part of the military, but they're a support element. And, the war's come to them now, too. Rob Reed did a really interesting take, teenage girl who sees the war come to her family, her mother disappears, her father's being harassed, and they're trying to push her younger brother into the state indoctrination system they're setting up, schools, and is trying to fight against all that with no real background for it, and with some manuals and some info from the intel community. Mike Massa's is a retirement home for spooks. I called him up. I said, so you've seen Red? He says, yeah. I said, you've seen The Prisoner? He says, yeah. I said, all right, so it's a retirement home for spooks, but it's completely voluntary. They move there because they can, and if one of them gets drunk and starts blabbing, it doesn't matter because everybody's read in. And it's this beautiful retirement home in the mountains, and the UN decides that's a perfect place to put its bioweapons research scientists. And the retirees are so helpful. They're happy to, sweep the floors, vacuum the rugs, suck the data out of the hard drives, funnel it to the resistance. They have no idea of the qualifications of these. It's just some worn out old woman in her travel chair.
It was like evil golden girls.
Yeah. Yeah, let's say it was Red meets the prisoner. And then Marissa Wolf has one of the smuggling ships, and they're juggling that they've got a UN contract to run supplies for the UN and getting paid for it, but their sympathies are with the resistance. But how can the resistance trust them when they're blatantly bringing in UN supplies? And then, of course, the UN isn't entirely sure it can trust them because, they were smugglers. How do we know they're being honest? And they've got an entire juggle between both elements. Chris Smith and Aaron Haskins. It's reminiscent of Kelly's Heroes, sort of. They're out in the in the boonies, and hey, there's a bank we can knock off. It's got all this, they've got actual bullion. And, there's a setup and a setup and a setup, and everybody's got some sort of setup and wants a take. Justin Watson, another Academy grad, he's medically retired, did a great story on, an UN element that's trying very hard to be as honorable and professional as possible, largely for the sake of their reputation. This is what they are. Regardless of the circumstances, they're going to fight the way it should be fought. And they're having to fight against their own bureaucracy on one side and a very dedicated resistance element on the other. And, I won't say that I've ever blackmailed somebody from the base safety office into leaving us alone to get our mission done, but I've seen it happen. It's great when everybody's got cameras all the time. When I was in the Middle East, you have safety regulations for a reason. Rishlan? Okay, kind of blipped on me there. You have safety regulations for a reason, but in the middle of a war zone, they're sometimes a hindrance to actually performing the mission. One of those. Did I miss any stories?
Cordova.
Just haven't I covered? Jason Cordova. Yeah, Skywheel. The Skywheel coming down. Yes. Yeah, I'd reference that in Freehold. He did a great job of.
I was going to say he set us up so well with that. I mean, that was one of our favorites to do. That really was, because. Believe it or not, I used as a little bit of source material. I dug up an old post on Post Katrina and a shelter commander at Keesler Air Force Base. So we dug up a little bit of that to go with it. I'll shut up. I mean, but that we really loved writing after that. I mean, that was something else.
Yeah, the Skywheel orbiting cargo delivery system has been discussed in science fiction frequently. And so the invaders start taking it over for their own cargo and monitoring the civilian cargo. And, stuff starts going a little bit off target. Supplies get lost in the ocean. They crash into the wilderness where, they get looted by the rebels. And eventually it comes down to, eventually it comes down to a fight for control of it. And it's covered in Freehold. It crashes. It comes out of orbit. Well, when a chunk of mass that size comes out of orbit, where is it going to hit and what damage is it going to do? Kendra didn't get to see that from her point of view, but other people did. And then Casey and Rob Hampson covered the scientists who, effectively, not for that reason, but effectively suicided through the jump point, one of the jump points, and took it out. they were going down anyway. They took that out. So all the logistics now has to come around. It's like basically losing the Panama Canal. all of a sudden, you've got to make a drastic change in your logistics. And stuff you had in transit has just delayed. Every one of these things messes with the ability to conduct a war.
Yeah.
Doc Walrab had a story too.
Cool.
Right? Oh, yes. And Doc Walrab covered a couple of surviving special ops guys leading a very unusual resistance element out in the boonies. And they're pacifistic religious types, but well, not that pacifistic. I mean, they've got some rockets and some artillery, and they're more than happy to fight an enemy who's trying to eliminate their lifestyle. Well, so I hope I haven't missed anyone. We already discussed Larry's.
Yeah.
I was just looking through the table of contents, and I think you've covered everything.
Yeah. We tried to get as broad as possible, mostly on planet, and there'll be some in the habitats following up. But whether it's in the middle of the city or far out in the boonies, everyone's got some kind of plan on what they can do. And there were entire movements during World War II. They were being encouraged. It's like anything you can do, if you can slow down production of the factory slightly, it helps. Anything that causes the enemy to have to change their plans or pull back is ultimately beneficial. And if everything hits all at once, it turns into a very effective weapon. On the intel stuff, because
absolutely.
She was tying all these together and then filling in a bit of point of view we didn't have. And so whatever she's got on.
From the intel perspective, there's actually some of the hacks that they mention as their gateways into the UN network. All ones that we're aware of have happened on the global level, or ones I personally witnessed someone doing something stupid and leaving something wide open, and we're all going, "You did what? You please tell me no." And so there's a lot of the technical. I tried to keep it technical without being technical. I didn't want to get into the actual technical weeds, because that far in the future, we don't know how any of the technology is going to actually evolve. We do know how people interact with technology, and that's the baseline of information security and security in general, all of this stuff. So I had to go through and go, okay, so this is what people are actually going to do. No, it's stupid, but we know that's what they're going to do. So the personal email server, all the jokes we ever want to make about that, I've actually seen some of these get set up, and yeah, they were hooked up where they shouldn't have been and caused problems.
Your main character and sort of traffic controller of everything is her name Moira Kelly, isn't it? She's kind of a droll sort who handles things well when they're all crazy. Tell us a little bit more about her, perhaps, and her role in the overall.
So Moira is an IT nerd. She's a bit crippled due to a childhood accident. So whatever her aspirations of being part of the military were, they went right up in smoke. But she was raised in the IT security world. She took the family business over from her mother. And she has a lot of contacts. Some of them are on the what we would consider less than legal side, but well, it's Freehold, so well, it's interesting.
It's
but
gray.
She's got contacts on the very strictly white hat, the very strictly black hat, and the people who, well, what's the money look like? She's got contacts with the really wealthy business owners who have particular dislikes of people's preferences. That's actually what they're doing at the very beginning, is they're trolling through they're using one of their moles in space to get check out what people have on their ships, as they're coming through the system, because he really doesn't like people who hurt children. So they have an outstanding contract on information that allow him to clean these kind of individuals away. They leapfrog from that, using a lot of that to hook in to the space station networks and Skywheel and all of that. They're using that to try to piecemeal things together. And she kind of goes, you know, she has friends in the military. She's watching things go to hell right as it happens. And her grandmother's from Earth and going, the hell we're going to let them do this? So she goes, they're kind of like, well, we're, guess we're in on it. From there, they work together. She gets hooked up with the remnants of the military who go, we know about your work. We worked with your mother. We know about your work. And from there, she gets as much official sanction as there is to start using this as a communications platform / information gathering, trying to feed it into an artificial intelligence to filter things and disperse the information. Because the biggest problem, from her perspective, is if people don't know what's going on, they can't do anything. So she's trying to get the information in and then get it out to the right people. It becomes a bit of a shell game, really. She's got to move all these pieces without exactly knowing what they are into a pattern that actually keeps working.
One of the things from a military perspective is once you know your database has been accessed, you have to assume it is entirely compromised. So every time there's an effective hack, you have to assume that literally the enemy knows everything, because it's dangerous to assume otherwise. And you know, she has them pulling.
Part of their job is of destroying small details to keep it damaged as long as possible without them realizing what's going on. And then siphoning all the information out as possible.
What are some of your examples of that?
At one point I have her team go through and send bereavement notices to family on Earth and bereavement notices to soldiers, UN soldiers stationed on planet or in station, for things that people haven't died. I have elite leave being approved, and also
we're so sorry to hear about your grandmother
errors.
And grandma's fine.
Yeah.
So very quickly, no one
because
can trust
everyone.
Yeah, no one can trust a death notice. No one can trust a not death notice. Yeah, it's it's a psyop overload.
Well, it strikes me that this Mike is just thinking about it. You know, considering the quality of contributors you have and the depth of experience and the care that these people take with your world, that you know this book itself could sort of be a manual for how to conduct resistance. What would you say to that?
So when I'm editor at large for Survival Blog, and they'll do a blurb for me, and I told Jim Rawls, I said, you know, if you were going to put together a resistance, these are the people you would actually want setting it up. Yeah, yeah, it's I had hopes for how it would turn out, but it turned out even better. Just like, you know, the last time I tried something like this, it was a outrageous amount of work. It was actually, you know, keeping continuity for everything. And everybody wanted to cover the beginning of the war. Everybody wanted to cover the first 6 weeks. Like, guys, this war lasts almost 3 Earth years. Somebody's got to cover the depths of winter in the middle of nowhere. and towards the end.
Yeah, I'm trying to make that all smooth out was fun, quote unquote. Lots of fun.
Yeah, Jess had to keep coordinating with me on so-and-so's story is actually, and I have to coordinate with Jamie. Okay, Jamie, so if we move this there, what's that?
No, don't.
And
there were some bits where, you know, well, this story makes sense if it fits here better. I'm like, okay, except, you know, it hasn't happened yet, and it's referenced in this story over here.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Oh no. So how are we going to square this circle? And it was some hoop jumping, but we got it all ironed out, and I think the result's pretty tremendous.
And on the whole, I mean, it's a PSYOP how-to and a PSYOP nightmare. I mean, you know, literally, the enemy can trust nothing. They can't trust their own communications. They can't trust their own intel, their own weapons. There's nothing that is assured. You know, they get up every morning,
and
it's like, I'm going to be alive tonight.
I cross-checked on, because mine is... the technical, without being technical, I cross-checked with a couple of the Uber geeks I know to double-check me. Does this actually work plausibly for my progression of how this works? And one replied with, so when did you kidnap my how-to manual on how to run a resistance? It's like,
yeah.
I didn't.
Yeah, one is a professional black hat. The government hires him to hack other people.
Yeah,
he was impressed. So I was like,
that,
well, cool, good.
he has done that. He does other things, but yeah, that's his kind of level. He's the sneakier sort than I am.
And you know, the one of the things with Jess's story, you know, they've got the Freehold forces have a backdoor into the UN drones, so the intel is being made available, and then it's being subtly changed, so routes are off slightly. Nothing blatantly obvious, because you don't want to give away the fact that you've got access to their drones and you're using them for your purposes. You know, until it reaches a tipping point, at which point the drones wipe out their own convoys. And that is the last anyone uses a drone in this system. You know, the moment the enemy might control your drones, you stop using drones. Well, what do you replace them with when your tactics are built around using them?
And that's part of the technology slam that they suffer, is they're dependent on these things that aren't theirs anymore.
Yeah, they can't go look.
Chris,
that's a PSYOPs on that part, too.
As Chris and Jamie have General Huff say, it's like, it's going to take a lot more, it's going to take boots on the ground, a lot more boots.
Yeah, that was, the loss of the technological edge is huge. Because, like you said, for one thing, it makes it easier to write when you can revert back to things you're already familiar with. I mean, you can speculate on tactics and whatnot all day long, but it helped. But also just demonstrating the paranoia. I mean, James, I think you have paranoia at the top of made sure that...
But there's a reason we still teach those tactics.
Anyone who's never been in a toxic unit can appreciate that.
There's a reason we still teach the old tactics, is because there's times when you need them.
Yeah, exactly, and that's also part of the reason why you study old battles and whatnot, too, still, is, I mean, it's...
Good tactics never die.
Well, Mike, you want anything else to add? You want to take us out with a final thought?
There was apparently some minor miscommunication when we were putting this together on exactly what it was, and the word count ran longer than Bain anticipated, and... Tony Weisskopf said, well, we had to, you know, split into two books. And I said, well, we can't really split this into two books. So a couple of stories got pulled out for purposes of space. So I put those aside and a couple of others. And I've already got three or four submissions in. So there's basically an immediate follow-up to this that's not quite so interactive, but still covers the same time frame and more action. Then it's got a little more humor in some spots. so we hope to have that ready shortly. Yeah. So yeah, one of Jamie's tricks in that is amusing, and a couple others. But yeah, so there will be an immediate follow up to this. Anyone who likes it should look out for that. It's not named or finished as of yet, but hopefully will be shortly. This was a very challenging project. But I'm absolutely ecstatic with how it turned out. I mean, it's a how-to manual on PSYOPs, on rebellion, on you know, counter operations. You know, everyone in there has esteemable credentials. We've got like 4 academy graduates, 6 officers. Almost everyone is a veteran, except for 2 world-class scientists, Jess and Rob Hampson. We got a couple of just civilian storytellers.
Rob Reed.
Yeah, but who's also a weapons expert, and so is Larry. And you know, there's a tremendous amount of technical expertise, but they're also really good writers. And the end result is, all right, let's throw down. Boom. And it just gets darker and tenser. And, you know, you're feeling sorry for the bad guys partway through because they're just, you know, they're never going to have a good day. Even if they win, they're not going to have a good day. And at the end of it, it's a very exciting project. I'm not doing it again.
Well, it's a great book, an amazing project that you pull off with style and line. It is Freehold Resistance, edited by Michael Z. Williamson, and really want to thank Jessica Schlenker, Christopher Denote, and Jamie Denote, and Jamie Ibsen for. And of course, Michael Z. Williamson, for talking about Freehold Resistance with us. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks.
That was part 2 of a 2-part roundtable discussion. Part 1 is available on last week's podcast. Now we continue with the complete audiobook serialization of Son of the Black Sword by Larry Correia, Book 1 in the Saga of the Forgotten Warrior. After the War of the Gods, the demons were cast out and fell to the world. Mankind was nearly eradicated by the seemingly unstoppable beasts. Until the gods sent the great hero Ram Rowan to save them, he united the tribes, gave them magic, and drove the demons into the sea. But as centuries passed, the descendants of the great hero grew in number and power. They became tyrannical and cruel, and their religion nothing but an excuse for greed. The people rose up, and the surviving royalty and their priests were made casteless, condemned to live as untouchables. The age of law had begun. Ashok Vidal has been chosen by a powerful ancient weapon to be its bearer. He is a protector, a member of an ancient military order of roving law enforcers. No one is more merciless in rooting out those who secretly practice the old ways as Ashok, but Ashok isn't who he thinks he is. And when he finds himself on the wrong side of the law, the consequences lead to rebellion, war, and perhaps transformation. Now here is the latest entry in Larry Correia's Son of the Black Sword.
Chapter 48. The warriors had retreated, leaving Ashok momentarily alone, exhausted and shaking. So much blood had been spilled on the bridge that it had melted the ice beneath them into a pink slush. The ditch was filled with floating bodies. More had rolled down the bridge to collect at the base. He wasn't sure why the Somsak were falling back, but he was thankful for the chance to catch his breath. At this point, the heart of the mountain was doing everything it could to keep his body functioning, despite the many wounds he'd received. Sensing danger, Ashok casually lifted the Somsak shield and let another crossbow bolt strike it. Thwack! There were so many bolts embedded in the wood that it was far heavier now than when he'd first taken it off a warrior, foolish enough to stick it in his face. He glanced across the waiting army. How many of them have I killed so far? There had been no need to turn in an after-action report to the Order, so he'd not bothered to burn each wound he'd administered into his memory. They'd all blurred together into a never-ending stream of tattoo-faced maniacs, spitting up blood and organs. Ashok looked at the sun. How many hours had he been fighting? He wasn't sure. But one way or the other, it would be over soon. A Somsak in finely crafted heavy armor was approaching the bridge. alone. That would be their champion. The rest had worn him down in body and spirit, and now the best among them would finish him off. When the warrior carelessly stepped on the bodies at the base of the bridge, one of them turned out to be unconscious rather than dead and woke up screaming when his champion's boot spread his wound. The champion paid him no heed, and the helmet's narrow eye slits remained focused on Ashok. The wounded soldier lingered for another few minutes before fading away. The champion continued his advance. He carried a huge steel shield and had a large sword resting over one shoulder. It was more of a sharpened steel bar than a proper sword. The warrior was either incredibly strong or incredibly foolish to choose such a cumbersome weapon. The champion walked up the bridge until they were only a few strides apart.
Remember me?
It was a different voice, but he knew it was the same man. Ashok gave him a slow nod.
Nadan Somsak. I didn't recognize you without the swagger.
I've come for my revenge and to claim my new sword, Protector. When I'm done here, none of you will go to waste. After I'm done raping your corpse, I'll make a mask from your skin, feed your flesh to my hounds, and use your skull as a bowl. I wonder who it is you defend across this bridge. Know that no matter what, I will find them, and when I'm through with them, they'll beg for death and curse your name.
The dry rasp of his words was somehow familiar. It reminded Ashok of the sea.
I took your tongue. How can you speak?
A wizard fixed me.
He'd never have the gift of working magic, but even Ashok could sense the demonic corruption in the air like a faint scent oozing through the cracks in the black armor. Nadan Somsak was now the foulest sort of lawbreaker. Ashok wasn't a protector of the law anymore, but he'd destroy such a thing on principle. Normally, he would have struck down a hybrid abomination immediately, but he was glad for the chance to rest for a moment. The longer Nadan talked, the better the heart could knit together his many wounds.
So you found a new tongue. Too bad it's as foul and stupid as the first one.
You're already beaten. You're weaker than last time, and I'm far stronger.
Good. Our last duel consisted of me drawing and striking once.
Ashok had never fought one before, nor had any of Angruvadal's previous bearers, but Mindarin had taught him that hybrid abominations were always unpredictable and more powerful than either of the species they'd been spawned from. They were among the worst things that could happen when someone toyed with illegal magic, and their existence was the Inquisition's single greatest fear.
Things are different now, Ashok. Once you're dead, the sword is mine.
You may kill me, but Angruvadal will never accept you.
It will have no choice. Why aren't you afraid, Ashok? You know you should be. You know what you face. So you should be begging for a quick end. No. The rumors are true. You're not brave at all. You're nothing more than a wizard's broken toy. You're no hero. You're a puppy tricked into thinking it's a wolf.
We're both abominations. But unlike you, I had no choice.
They had the small bridge to themselves, but the Somsak troops were crowded around the base and the sides of the ditch, eager to watch the duel and struggling to hear their Thakur's whispers. Ashok ignored Nadan and loudly addressed his men instead.
I commend you, warriors. You fought hard. I've traveled across all of Lok, and I've never met anyone with more courage and dedication than you've shown here today.
They seemed confused at the compliment from a man who'd already struck down so many of them. There were angry murmurs as Ashok's words were repeated and relayed through the assembled Somsak.
I wonder, with men so valiant, surely they must not know what kind of creature they're serving. Your Thakur's speech is no miraculous healing. Silence! Nadan Somsak demanded as he took a step forward. Nadan Somsak's blood mingles with corruption. He's made a pact with demons. There was no time to see the warrior's reaction because the executioner's blade came crashing down. The attack was so incredibly fast that Ashok barely had time to move aside before it shattered ice and pulverized the stone beneath. Ashok lunged, driving Angruvadal towards the Somsak's breastplate. But somehow, the heavy shield was there in time, knocking his attack aside. The giant sword rose far too quickly, bits of stone and dust raining from it. And then it was moving in a terrible, sweeping arc. Ashok ducked beneath as it whistled overhead. Crouched, he hacked at Nadan's legs, but the Thakur lowered the shield, and Angruvadal struck a gash in the steel instead. Nadan was able to step back, unharmed. The Somsak Thakur was moving with a demon speed, only he'd retained his warrior skill. Nadan launched another mighty overhand blow. Ashok intercepted it with his shield. There was a horrendous crack as wood splintered, leather split, and a terrible shock travelled down the bones of his arm. Strong as a demon, too. Wasting no time, Ashok went after his opponent, striking repeatedly, thrusting and cutting, but Nadan wielded the heavy blade like it was a fencer's toy and stifled his attacks. Ashok struck with all his might, bringing his indestructible sword down against Nadan's blade, a move that might have bent or broken a normal sword, but all it did was chip it. That thing was more like a sharpened piece of farm equipment than a mortal's weapon. Nadan intercepted Ashok's following attacks, then slammed his shield forward. Ashok caught it with his own shield, but it was like hitting a brick wall, and Ashok slid back across the red ice. They parted and circled. Ashok watched his opponent, how he stood, how he put his weight down on the slippery bridge, how he held his shield and shifted his heavy sword, and could discern no weakness. Ashok took the initiative and made an aggressive move to the side, trying to strike over the top of the shield. But Nadan caught it, and then the two were trading blows back and forth. They broke apart again, with Ashok breathing hard and arms burning, but with nothing to show for it other than several new dents in Nadan's shield. Nadan came at him, swinging high, trying to force him to the edge of the bridge. Ashok struck his flat with the edge of his own blade, disrupting the attack, and then he drove his body forward, crashing into the shield and trying to knock it out of the way. Nadan lifted an armored knee and struck Ashok in the side, hard enough to lift him into the air. The helm dipped forward suddenly, and an antler struck him in the head, splitting open his scalp.
That was another entry in the complete audiobook serialization of Son of the Black Sword by Larry Correa. And that's it for the podcast. Thanks to Audible.com and to podcast theme composer Ruth Judkowitz and the leavings of a charred planet after the Great Galactic Barbecue Cook-Off, a treat which is actually quite good, crispy on the outside with lots of diamonds and heavy metal ores to crunch on within, plus thanks and praise to Michael Z. Williamson, Jessica Schlenker, Chris Denote, Jamie Denote, and Jamie Ibsen, editor and authors of Freehold Resistance. Please join us next time, here on the hammering heart of science fiction and fantasy. And keep reaching for the stars.